Okay, this is out now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron. Abe is out on vacation, but this is another special bonus episode where I spoke with Terrence Johnston about Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis, recorded right after I had seen the film, as I will explain in a second. Here we go.
Go.
Now, from visionary writer and director Francis Ford Coppola, comes an event nothing can prepare you for.
Imagine today's society as a branch of civilization about to reach a dead end. Is this way we're living the only one that's available to us?
All right, I'm here now with the man from Le Noir Artur, Terrence Johnston.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. We are in person.
Yes.
Speaking in each other's faces.
Uh-huh. Something we don't do for a podcast.
Yes.
We talk a lot.
Literally.
We never do this podcast
Literally never do this podcast in person.
So, I have you here with me because I just got out of a screening of Megalopolis in its IMAX fan event, whatever they want to call it, showing.
Uh-huh.
You've seen Megalopolis.
I have.
And you've desperately wanted to talk about Megalopolis. Now, I'm coming in hot with this because I've literally just got out of the theater,
uh-huh.
So I have very fresh opinions
okay. On
the film. But that's what we're going to do right now. We're going to talk about the film Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis, as it says on all the posters.
Yes.
So, yeah, let's do that.
The movie... I've messaged you and was like, the second you walk out of the theater, I need a review. So I'm glad we're doing this because I saw it last month, 2 months ago. No, I saw it in July.
Okay.
And the amount of movie you get in this movie is so astounding. I don't know if it's good, but you do get a lot of movie.
An entirely fair statement.
Yeah. I thought... I'll tell you my thoughts from...
Sure.
It's a lot of movie.
Mm-hmm.
Some might say too much. I might be one of the some that said too much. I think that I was enthralled by, like, the setting and the vibe of, like, modern day ancient Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was going one place, and then the movie went another, and so that's why I don't know if it was good. But, like, the setting, like, the sort of Shakespearean... Because, like, when it first started, I was like, oh, he's just doing, like, a Shakespeare adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one of Shakespeare's play, and we're going in a Julius Caesar direction. And then it sort of zigs and zags and... weaves and goes in these weird even now it's hard to explain what the hell that movie is.
Yeah, that's a very fair way to put it. It describing what this movie is not going to be something that's simple for the general audience that walks in and is like,
oh yeah,
Megalopolis, I saw that, it's about Adam Driver and ... like, so, like I said, I just got it. So I'm forming opinions or what have you.
Yes.
But I do have some main takeaways that can kind of surmise where I'm at with it. Because I mostly really like this movie. A lot of that comes from the fact that I just admire the ambition.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think, unless you're just really against this film, I feel like it's at least hard to deny that there's ambition on display.
A lot, yes.
There's from a filmmaker who certainly... has a reputation for going big or experimenting in any number of things. He certainly, it doesn't feel like he's lost any steps in like what he's trying to do here.
Yeah.
So the two main things that caught me, one is having my last year of college, where I was a history major,
yes.
My last year of college, ancient Rome was one of my main courses from
uh-huh.
college. So I have a pretty solid knowledge of like the timeline of things happening or
yes.
whatnot, along with just familiarity with the topic and like not that movies are the way to like understand things, but like
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of movies that deal with a lot of the things that are happening, honestly, with the characters based around. So regardless, I hearing that Coppola wanted to make a film that was what if ancient Rome was fitted on top of modern America,
yeah,
I didn't realize how literal that was going to be.
Yeah.
So that really caught me off guard, because it's not just like, oh, that's a neat concept. It's,
no, it's,
oh, no, you have a Caesar, you have Crassus, you have all these characters that are like, I know what this story is.
Yeah.
Which is also why, like, if I really wanted to figure out how to tell this, like, tell somebody what this movie is, I could probably find a way to do that based on just what Rome was,
uh-huh.
which I do find interesting. That's a neat thing that I did not see coming. I thought it would be more or less the idea of a Rome as opposed to, it's straight up ancient Rome. Like, yes, filtered through, like, Shakespeare's version of Julius Caesar, uh-huh. along with other Shakespearean things, like you mentioned. There's a lot of Shakespeare on his mind, it seems. So that's one thing. The other thing... I think it's mostly very good because I do think I feel like the climax is not big enough for me.
It's clunky.
I feel like it kind of like reaches an end point and I'm thinking I feel like we could have gone bigger. Like for a movie that was already going very big for its 2 hour and 20 minute runtime, like, oh, we just got to stop. Like I get what it's doing and it leans into Coppola's optimism that he's trying to express throughout this film through Driver's character, mainly, but it does feel like for all the stuff that we set up and all the characters we have to work with and all the potential devastation that could be on display, it kind of just like wraps up really quick. Like, oh, we're done. Okay.
Yeah. I don't think it earned the optimism.
I would agree.
And I wonder if hewing more to a Shakespeare tragedy,
yes,
but from the tragedy comes the optimism,
mm-hmm.
we would have ended up in a better place. Because, like, he really rushes the hell out of this ending. Like, the people that need to get their comeuppance, and we're happy, and everything is going to be fine and great moving forward. And it's kind of like, but that is not the tale we just watched.
Let alone the tale of, Caesar. Ultimately,
yes.
So it's like, okay.
And it's so, I loved the grafting of ancient Rome onto sort of modern New York City,
mm-hmm.
in the ways that it was, like the costuming.
Yes.
You know, the characters, the production design, like how people were relating to each other,
mm-hmm.
the politics of it, I thought that was really fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, at every moment, I just was like, I will do another Madison Square Garden as the Colosseum moment. Mm-hmm. Like, I will accept that because it's so cool and interesting how he's trying to graft it on there. It goes so many wild places. Like, that's why I don't think the optimism is earned. Because, like, at one point, it feels like ancient Rome mapped onto New York. Then it's like a drug-induced haze. Like, when Coppola must have had this idea in the 70s. You know, he, in his delirium, while deadly sick, trying to film Apocalypse Now. Right? And was like, I had this brilliant idea.
He has been working, like, he started writing it in the 80s, but yes, he's had this idea for decades. It's gone through so many various forms and whatnot.
Yeah, because I do feel like there's some interesting ideas within it, and like...
Actually, just to pause you real quick, sorry, because there was a Q&A before the movie started, featuring Francis Ford Coppola, Robert De Niro, and Spike Lee, which is a bit odd when I say that out loud. It's like, why are those two there and not like actors from the film? Regardless, that was something Robert De Niro briefly spoke on. He read in an original early reading of the script with other people, and he mentioned himself, Uma Thurman, and Paul Newman were all there at the time. Robert De Niro would have been the Adam Driver character at that point in time.
And Uma would have played Natalie
Emmanuel, yeah.
Wow.
Paul Newman, I assume, would be like John Voight, I guess?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh. That he would have had a time with that part.
Yeah.
To me, it's not good. It's not terrible. It's not good. It's not, because like, even I just was on like a roller coaster with this movie where at points I was like, this might be the dumbest thing I have seen this year. And other points where I was like, oh, this is really fascinating. I see why a director would want to do this. I see what he's going here. I see the themes, you know, and how interesting it feels. And sometimes both of those thoughts came in the same scene.
I agree with you, and although I do like the movie Morphe, but in terms of like what he's aiming for tonally, what I like about a lot of Coppola's stuff when it comes to his like ways of experimenting, whether it's whether it's one of his early 70s masterpieces, his 80s experimental stuff, or even something like Tetro in his 2000s, like, I always feel like he's aware of the movie he's making. And by that I mean, I know there's, you know, there's movies where you can watch where it's unintentionally funny. Or there's something that there's a camp value that's maybe not intended at the time, but it becomes a part of the conversation when you talk about the movie. I'm not going to say that Coppola has just the finest reads of anyone that could ever think of anything that's funny or what have you. But I do think when he's looking at his movies and the reason why he has so many edits of his movies and why he takes so long to make his films, I think it's because he's well aware of the kinds of responses and kinds of reactions his scenes can generate. And he's not one that's opposed to having mixed reactions to his films because he likes provoking conversation. He likes to be a provocative. That's not me saying that the movie's inherently good because he does that. Yeah. But I do think he has more of a self-awareness than other filmmakers in general.
And I think having that self-awareness is good. I think, you know, in terms of him trying to make it provocative, I do think sometimes this movie's attempt to sort of be extremely showy or be extremely in your face with certain things, I think does a disservice to the story. Like, I'm thinking of Adam Driver's character's sort of drunken haze that we're in. And it feels like it comes in and around that Coliseum, Madison Square Garden is a Coliseum scene, where I think some really, like, impactful character work is being done. I think some really... So it, like... It, like, provokes, right? And it sort of brings you into the mindset of this character. But it is so weird that it took me away from, like, the rhythm I had finally developed with the story. And then I had to get, like, back in that same rhythm. But I was like, you had me. So it sort of knocked me off of the alignment. And in the time it took me to get back, something else would come and knock me off the alignment. And, like, in a way, like I just mentioned Apocalypse Now, like, I think about, you know, he's in that hotel room and he's sort of going, right, like, that's the kind of, like, he, so we know Francis Ford Coppola can do that.
Yes.
It just is here, it honestly went on too long. I think if he had shortened it,
that specific sequence,
you know, there are just moments like that where I'm like, I get why you're going to the excesses, and I'm here for it in certain arenas, but, like, you're telling a modern version of an ancient tale. You are also doing a love story. You are also doing a family drama. You are also doing a sci-fi movie. And it's like, it's a lot of elements. It's a lot of elements, which I don't think that you can't have all of them, because, like, I do say it is working at certain times, but I do think that, like, at his most showy, he, like, gets away from what's interesting, and it, like, stops being about the blend of these things, and it starts being more about, like, let me do this really trippy sequence, or let me do this really weird thing over here. You know, like, you gotta...
Let me look at these things piece by piece. As I try to remember everything you just said.
ancient story.
I'll say we've
covered that.
In regards to, like, what he's done in the past when it comes to how do you depict certain states of mind or what have you, I would say, well, he's done versions of that before. Therefore, I like the idea that he's experimenting with new ways to tackle that same thing. It can be. And is there perhaps an excess in certain points?
Yes.
Perhaps there are. Now, what I would say to that is, another thing I do like about Coppola is his films are very layered. Layered in a sense where I'm not saying you have to see it more than once to really get it. But I do think
you don't need to see this more than once.
I look forward to seeing this again. I do believe that he's one of the kinds of filmmakers. I think Wes Anderson's a very modern version of another one where there is a great benefit to continuing to dig deeper by seeing it again. I think there's enough to explore where there's a benefit of getting, of wanting to take that journey to delve deeper. That's not saying it's a requirement, but I do think there's a benefit because he's a filmmaker that looks at things like, you don't look at paintings once. Why do you necessarily need to look at a movie once? I get that there's different commitments involved.
Yeah.
When it comes to a painting versus a movie, but I do think he has that kind of ingrained spirit when it comes to filmmaking. It's not about looking at something once and never paying attention to it again. It's like, no, I've made something designed for you to come back to it, and maybe you take away different interpretations. Well, now, what I'm saying to all that, I do feel like the things that, perhaps, regardless of you, perhaps I'm hung up on, if anything, those are things that I feel like those could wash away for me as far as being really problems in the future, and more just things I will either feel less, you know, troubled by or what have you, and I'll just be more accepting of that's what he was going for with this particular vision. If I want to speak to why I did like this movie, I mean, and we can talk about individual performances and what have you soon enough. I was constantly engaged by it. I don't think that's a hard thing to ask of a movie like this that's specifically trying to, you know, either provoke you or stimulate you or any number of things to kind of just keep your attention. I don't know if I'd say fast-paced, but I would certainly say it is doing a lot, as you mentioned. It moves.
It does move.
And I mean, you mentioned costumes. So, I mean, he spent $100 million on the movie. It looks like $100
million. Yeah, like, he spent $100 million.
I'm not going to, you know.
Particularly the ending.
I'm not going to say it's like the greatest use of special effects, but it's also essentially an independent film. So it's easy for me to kind of let go of how great it looks compared to fucking James Cameron. I mean, like, I get what we're doing here. What was I going to say? I don't lose the thought.
stuff that you like.
I'm trying to, like, there was a specific thing that I want to get to that's not performance related, because we'll get to that in a second. You mentioned, like, the showiness. There's a showmanship. And I mean, seeing Coppola, you know, he's one of these guys, right? Him and Spielberg and Lucas and Scorsese. And then, like, De Palma's kind of there in the background. So Spielberg's obviously he's gone the biggest as far as, like, kind of maximalized filmmaking and four-quadrant audiences and revolutionizing blockbusters. Scorsese's gone a different direction in terms of, like, he is a prestige guy. They're both prestige guys. But, I mean, he's more overtly, I'm not here to, like, market to the six-year-olds. I'm here to, like, make thought-provoking films based on my own. With Coppola and Lucas, I find them both interesting for, along with all the other things that are interesting, but, like, what Lucas isn't doing is capitalizing on the stuff he talks about. He's like, I have all these ideas for movies. He never makes them. He's not doing that. Coppola has. Coppola has put himself in a place where, yes, he made The Godfather, which, like, saved movie theaters in 1972, essentially.
Yeah.
But after doing these giant films, you know, those two Godfathers, he was still be able to make his conversation. He was still able to make Apocalypse Now, a film that nobody wanted him to make, and he made it anyway. He made
arguably
all
his best movie.
And, I mean, his 70s.
An iconic run of movies, yes.
So then you get to his 80s, where he's back and forth as far as, I'm funding stuff and I'm losing. I have to make other movies to make up for the fact that I'm losing. He's a guy that he's gone out of his way over and over again to, if he has something on his mind, he wants to explore that.
Mm-hmm.
That seems very apparent here as well.
Yes.
Where he's looked beyond the fact that he's put in so much of his own money to make Kevin Costner blush for this movie. He really wants to play with, like, what does that mean for me as a director? And that's not just get actors, put them in front of camera, and they read a script. It's much like Tetro was, I'm going to do live edits like I'm a fucking DJ on stage. Here he's like, I'm going to stop this movie halfway through, turn on the lights, and have someone in the theater start screaming lines at the screen.
That
I'm going to make this weird interactive element all of a sudden.
Yes, that really got me together. I was like, what is happening when I saw that? Yeah.
Without providing a context for why that's happening, there is, and I'm not sure if it's going to play in only IMAX screens of this film, or I can't imagine it's every, that's ridiculous. If
yeah.
Every screening of this movie. But like,
you definitely can't do that every screening.
But the presentation we had, that everyone had the IMAX screening for today, and that Terrence apparently had as well. There's a portion in the film where a press conference takes place. The lights in the theater go up, and there's like a person in the theater that screams out a question as if they're participating in the press conference that's going on within the film. Am I saying that this is the greatest idea ever? We should revolutionize cinema by doing this? No, I'm not saying that. But the fact that he wants to I'm not George Lucas, I'm not Star Wars, I can't just create new special effects. What's the thing that me, Francis Ford Coppola, can do? I like that that's where his head's at, where he's like, what if I made this work? And that's like, I can't take that for granted that he's like this 80-year-old man who's like, I want to play with the things that I have that are at my disposal.
I love the idea of the exploration and even that press conference moment. Did it take me out of the movie? Yes. But, like, it felt in line with, like, the excesses of the film. And it's, like, interesting exploration, like, in that way. Because I do think, obviously, Francis Ford Coppola had a very a decade even the other directors you named would dream of.
Sure, of course.
In the 70s. Like, even you know, Spielberg, as great as Spielberg is and has been, Scorsese, as great as he has been, I don't... We could put Francis Ford Coppola's run in the 70s is
oh, they were all jealous of him.
Yeah,
no question.
You know, and like with the types of movies, you know, obviously people felt a way about Spielberg because he was the commercial director, and like, you know, Francis Ford Coppola. I think what's so fascinating about that, like that man later in life, is like. Obviously, The Godfather is a great movie, but, you know, they tried to fire him multiple times, right? Apocalypse Now, they got hit with a hurricane. Everybody got sick. Almost died, right? Like, in the conversation, it's like, okay, Gene, you have an Oscar winner in Gene Hackman, but, like, this interior San Francisco set, like, so it's like his movies, in a way, like... In that particular run, are like a lot of their greatness obviously can be contributed to him, but just in like a, I don't know if they were supposed to be like these surefire massive hits. Maybe The Godfather because it was a best selling novel, but like the other, so he's got that sort of like, in a way that I think Lucas had a little bit. Like obviously Star Wars is like this massive giant thing that we have today, but like, you know, if it was going to be so popular and amazing, they wouldn't assign the merchandise rights away for to him, right? So it is interesting to
It speaks to why the 70s is just the greatest decade of film. There's so many weird risks and experiments.
Yeah, this late, you know, and we talked about In Cold Blood about how, you know, so I was like, well, I don't know if you could make the movie like this today. You know, it's very similar to the 70s. And so, like, I'm glad that spirit of experimentation still with him even these days. I do think that, like, not that this movie needed an editor, because obviously it's been through many revisions and it's been in different forms and with different actors, but I do think, and it's not even about necessarily reining in the excess, I just think it was maybe like centering it more.
That's, yeah, no, I can,
you know,
I can see what you're saying there.
Because I, after a while, I was kind of like, okay, like, the daughter of the rival, they're working together, now they're in, like, there's, like, all of these elements, and it's like, okay, even the time stopping, the sort of speculative fiction aspect of it, you know, is like, okay, like, interesting, we're playing with time, we're thinking about, you know, what we can do with the time that we have, and if we had more time, what could we do? And, like, there's these themes, and it's like, and then Shia LaBeouf becomes the leader of the minorities. rich.
It can't have the feel of,
you know,
I hate this generalization that people use as, like, oh, there should have been a series. I don't like that at all. There is an aspect of this that's like, you could really stretch this out into being this, you know,
there's definitely a mini series. Yeah.
There's that amount of plot going on within this.
Yes.
I don't think that necessarily means Francis Ford Coppola should have made this a
two. No.
I'm not saying that whatsoever. But I do feel like, yes, he's trying to cram. So there's a kitchen sink approach going on here,
yeah,
based on the fact that it's a giant passion project. That's how giant passion projects usually work. They put everything they can into it.
Yeah.
They don't know if they're going to get to do it again.
And I think in moments, it's like he's having real fun. Like Aubrey, we can talk a little bit about performance. Yeah. Aubrey Plaza was my favorite performance in this movie.
Okay,
here is a woman who understands the movie that she's in. And Francis was like, I want you to do this. And she says, I got it. And it's so, like, even when that character's at the most unhinged, the most silly, the most whatever, I was always in lockstep with that character, because I was like, she's matching the excesses of what Francis is trying to go for, but there's still like a sort of a real grounded person in there, and so I really, really dug that.
That's a good thing to point out, that there's the fact that, yes, goes high, but there is a grounded person inside of there. Because I would say, I don't think this is a bad casted movie at all. I think everyone rather very much fits what they're doing.
Yes.
But I could agree that there are others that feel more, they feel implemented in just the right way because, yes, there's some inner thing going on there that I can really feel, where yeah, others are just there because, hey, we're here. We can show up.
I think Natalie and Adam were solid. I think Adam just has some just unenviable task of like anchoring some
That's
of the
thing. He has so much to do.
Craziest foolishness in this movie. And so I do think, but like the performance is not bad. And it's tough because he's playing sort of like a detached guy, you know, who becomes attached, but like can't outwardly express that.
That's one of the things I look forward when I eventually see it. Uh-huh. I'm gonna race it to see this movie.
When you rewatch it and you become the person asking the questions in the interview portion
exactly
of the movie.
Exactly, when I become the audience plant. That is the performance I want to look at more closely as far as looking at all the different things he's required to do. Because I do think he has to do it. He's the lead. He has to do a lot. And I do think that can be a tricky kind of, that's, you know, anybody that has like the lead performance in the midst of an ensemble cast where so many of them are doing a certain thing. When you put someone in the lead, that's generally a more, you know, quote unquote boring role.
Mm-hmm.
Adam Driver's not a boring actor, so he doesn't really have that problem generally. Mm. He knows how to take his quirks or take what, you know, whatever essence he's going for and kind of bring that out. But this is a film that, yes, it puts him not only in a task of like leading this thing, but also he has to have a very distinct personality compared to everybody else, where everyone else is pretty much looking out for themselves to some degree.
Yes, that's a great way of saying.
He's the only one who's the theme of the movie, which is, you know, unity and doing all these things for a greater mm-hmm. good and whatnot. He's the one that's outwardly representing that spirit, which is what Coppola's whole thing is with this movie. So it's like, that's a tough job. Mm-hmm. I agree with you that he's good in it. I don't think it's his best performance, but I still think he's very good in it. I would agree, Natalie Emanuel. I think she's also very good as this kind of idealist that wants to see the best in people and has to try not to get dragged down into the mud like everybody else that's around her seems to be, including mm-hmm. Giancarlo Esposito.
Fun.
Giancarlo Esposito, he's having a good time. I like that he's not playing just evil bad guy, because that's so much of what he's been given these days. So, like,
that's true.
I like that he has this kind of, he's one that also has this kind of grounded sense to him, like much like the Aubrey Plaza character, where he's this like mayor that's not really well liked, but he has a lot of power. But at the end of the day, he cares about his daughter. Like, I like that. That's his deal. I think John Voight is good in this movie. I think he's having the right kind of fun here too. For all the John Voight stands for, I do think that he gets his assignment.
I'm intrigued by the way Francis cast this movie.
Yeah.
With people who at the time were problematic.
Yeah. Him, Shia LaBeouf, and Dustin Hoffman.
And so it presents quite the conundrum. I think that I feel like Shia used that in the performance.
It's very, I feel like that's
he's
very,
playing a despicable character.
I feel like that's very clear. And Shia LaBeouf has this weird, his own self-awareness of who he is as a celebrity.
Yeah.
Where, yes, I think that feels very baked in, for sure.
So, yeah. Yeah, it's in, the performances are matching the movie, is what I will say. I don't feel like all of them were successful. I think part of that is just what Francis is asking them to do with the script is, what the script is having the characters do, it then bleeds into the performance. Like I said, Adam Driver, it's fine. But to me, it's like part of the performance is suffering just from the like extraness of what he's asked to do. And then, yeah, it just, something like Aubrey, I just came away just every second she was on screen, I was thrilled. You know,
and it is like, it's by default the most fun character in
yeah.
the movie.
And that well, does and help. The thing about what I find interesting, you talk about people trading on their public personas, is that Aubrey is like an actress that I see. I can't get a read on her.
But I think that's a good thing.
Like, but by that I mean like the way a lot of people love her and the things that she does and the type of person that she is, I'm just like, I can't fully get there. And not because she's not talented, mm-hmm. and not because she can't be funny, and not because she can't be good dramatically. There's something there, like in a Ryan Reynolds way, but not dreadful.
Well, I mean, if you want to talk about this, I mean, the difference here, I think, is that Ryan Reynolds isn't doing anything to really kill her outside the lines of what his personality is.
Well, he's not doing anything at
all. Aubrey Plaza, you know, I make no never mind about like who she is as a person or what have you, but in terms of like the performances she's given, what I like about the roles she's taken, especially in the recent years, is she's parlayed a certain type of personality that she portrayed both, you know, like red carpets or what have you, as well as in like Parks and Recreation,
yeah,
and turned that into a chance to explore other areas and color outside those lines. Whether it's, I mean, this recent movie, My Old Ass, where she has to do a number of different things, or a movie like Black Bear, which I really like, where she has to do a variety of different things. Like, it's not just play sardonic teenage character or sardonic 20-something character or sardonic 30-something character now, because people age. I do think that there are, or like White Lotus, I think, is a great example of that, because she's not the comedic, yeah. She's not the comedic force of White Lotus in that season she's in. She plays very much a dramatic character that's going through real human problems. Those are all choices that she's making that I think show various sides of what talent she has, what range she has. And not to just pick on Ryan Reynolds, but I don't think Ryan Reynolds really, he doesn't have the at least now, he, you know, when you're making billion-dollar movies at a time, it's like, why should I
you
keep,
don't have
why
to,
should I
you
try?
You don't have to hold back your Ryan Reynolds hate to me. I, you know, but yeah, it's
but
like,
so well, yeah, so in a movie like this where, yeah, she's just gets to be unleashed,
yeah,
satirical take on like newscaster / Machiavellian villain, like,
oh yeah,
yeah, that's a lot of, there's a lot of room to play with that and have a good time with that, but you still get enough of her in the kind of quieter moments where, yes, there's a real person there, like,
oh yeah,
saying,
yeah.
So, yeah,
I just she thrilled me in this movie, and this is coming from somebody who is agnostic to her, maybe, is the way I would describe it.
I, fair enough.
I appreciate her. Good Obviously, day. She's in Agatha All Along, right? And, like,
yes,
literally blew the doors off of the first episode. The lesbian sexual energy that was coming from that character from the second she stepped on the screen, I was like, okay, this is a great jolt of energy. So like she can't. I do enjoy her in things.
Like Legion was another example of that, where she got to vamp it up, and that was at that time. That was a different part for her to take, because at that time she was just coming from Parks and Rec and like random supporting funny roles in other movies.
Yeah,
and that was a chance for her to play like, she's like a horror villain. She's a best friend sidekick character. She's like a bunch of different things in one, because that show's fucked up.
Yeah,
I also did like seeing Lawrence Fishburne in here.
Yeah.
Partially because just think of that history. He's 15 years old back in Apocalypse Now, where you lied about his age. He's 15 years old back in Apocalypse Now,
yeah.
And now here he is over 50 years later, you know, popping up as just the voice of the voice of,
yes.
Of the whole show, plus, like, the Adam Driver's driver.
Yeah.
That's fun to say.
His sort of right-hand man, in a way, yeah.
He, like, it's not like he's required to do much, but just, like, it's just neat to think, like, oh, Lawrence Fishburne's like, Larry Fishburne from Apocalypse Now, here he is.
Yeah.
In the future. Hanging out.
Yeah,
not a lot to do for Talia Shire or Catherine Hunter, who pops up in here. Although Catherine Hunter, because of her kind of theatrical background, she knows how to play the very small bits that she has in this movie. Who else is... You're not mentioning it. Dustin Hoffman shows up for a bit. Schwartzman shows up for like a bit. They don't really do much in this movie.
Whoever played the not virgin virgin.
Oh, it's Grace Vanderwall, I believe is her name.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That was I enjoyed. Can you tell that the Colosseum the Madison Square Garden stuff was my favorite portion of the movie. I was locked. That's when Francis really had me. I said, okay, I'm now fully immersed in the Rome of it. I love the excess of this. I love the plotting. I love, you know, all of this foolery.
Yeah, as I'm like piecing together all these things and, you know, still, you know, letting it kind of marinate in my head. There's a lot of like sustained sequences I quite enjoyed as far as like what he's aiming for, not only from like a script level, but in terms of just like production. And yes, having Madison Square Garden be a literal coliseum with chariot races or what have
you,
that's great. That's really
cool. Really cool.
The early sequence, like pretty much one of the first sequences where like everybody's together, where they're on these, I believe he, Driver's, Caesar, he's showing off like the model of what
they're on the catwalks,
and they're on all these catwalks that are like hanging, and it's like there's a cool factor there for me as far as this kind of we're like hanging precipitously on top of this catwalk structure that's, you know, very fragile, could break any second kind of thing, and we're having these intense conversations between our main players. There's stuff there that's really where like the Shakespearean drama hits hard, and like Francis Ford Coppola just showing you like how he can, you know, just use camera angles and settings to make a lot of statements without having to overtly say it. There's like stuff like that. There's not a lot of stuff throughout the film like that. There's a whole sequence with Driver and Emmanuel when they're hanging on like the rebars that are hanging out outside of his building. That's just very striking from a visual standpoint. I mean, there's a lot of stuff where I wouldn't even necessarily call it showy. It's just more, he has an idea of how to put this to screen, and he does it. It's not throwing it in your face necessarily.
Yeah.
And something like Chariot Race, it's like, that's not being showy. That's just being like, this is the movie. Like, I've got to show you what the movie
is. Yeah, it just was very, yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed that.
A comparison point, I would make, because I was trying to think, like, what movie is like this? Because there's not many. The closest I can think of offhand, as far as kind of ambition matched with exuberance and what have
Cloud Atlas.
Cloud Atlas is a good example, but like story wise, they have like nothing in common. No, the one I thought of is Chazelle's Babylon.
Oof.
That's the, like, regardless of where you think of about that movie,
oof,
and I'm okay on it.
I think Babylon,
but it
is dreadful.
But in terms of two directors that have very specific ideas of what they're doing, and they're throwing everything at the screen at you, and both can be very showy. Babylon, much more so.
I believe in my heart of hearts that every director should get $100+ million to make the craziest thing they could think of. I want to live in the world where that happens. Like, even though I think Babylon is dreadful, and I think Damien Chazelle was absolutely unhinged for the script, and that large portions of that movie are very stupid, and that he didn't know how to end the movie, I am so thrilled that he got to make that for a major studio. Just the same way, even though Francis Ford Coppola, you know, had to sell off his winery for this, I am glad that he got to make this thing just to see it and have something to react to.
It's funny, he clarified what he did as far as getting the money for this. He has three wineries. He merged one of them. The one that, because his family's all, you know, they're all busy doing other things, they can't manage his winery. So he's like, I'll merge this one with somebody else. And he did that. He got the money, did the loan stuff and whatever. So, like, he still has two other wineries.
Yeah. I mean, of course, he's never not going to be poor, right?
Yeah, I get that. So, but
AMC tomorrow is going to play Godfather 1 through 3.
Before we lose track of the Babylon thing.
Yes.
The other thing that I find interesting in making this connection that only I've made is Chazelle is, what, in his 30s, maybe? He's, like, our age.
He might be a little older.
Maybe younger, honestly.
Somewhere between 35 and 40.
Okay. Francis Ford Coppola, double that.
Yeah.
And then some. I'm curious how you think about this, because Chazelle's obviously, he's making Babylon, a movie set in the 20s, but he has the sensibilities of somebody that's his age, right?
Yes.
And he can, you know, he can tie in the themes or what have you with his own, how he interprets whatever. It reflects a movie made by a person of his age.
Yes.
Francis Ford Coppola is in a position where he has a younger cast, mostly, and he's making a movie set in the future, but he's still trying to tie it into what modern America looks like, but he's still an 80-something-year-old man making this movie through his eyes, through his writing. I'm still trying to, like, formulate how I feel about this myself, but do you think this movie feels like a film that's trying to tell a quote-unquote hipper or modern story that looks like something that's not made through his eyes?
I don't think he's trying to be hip.
I wouldn't say so either.
I think he's like, this idea of mapping modern trappings onto an ancient, like a new Rome, right? Doing new Rome. I think he was like, this is really freaking cool, right? Like, we look at America, you know, is the new Rome, New York City in particular, in this story. And it's like, yeah, we see that gigantic monuments to, you know, the human spirit, to the progress of men are in that city. It's the city that never sleeps. It's got all the money, right? It's got the exit, like, and he, like, amps that. He's like, great, that's a great place to map ancient Rome on. And it's like, that's what I found most fascinating, is because it's like such an interesting way. Like, I know there's that whole trend about, like, these women on TikTok were asking their boyfriends, like, how much do they think about the Roman Empire, right? Like, the Roman Empire being sort of the thing that we think about a lot. And it's like, Francis is like, okay, well, like, let me show you today's Roman Empire. But I also think that it's a movie made, I can feel his age in the movie. And the reason why I say that is, like, it feels like a guy who's, like, nearing the end of his life and is trying to tell everybody, we can be optimistic.
So are you saying that speaks well to the movie as far as feeling his age in the film?
Yes and no. I think some of his more problematic inner stuff is in the movie in a way that's not good for it. But I do think, like, the ending, like, ending up where we do, I do really think that that's, like, how he feels about it now. Like, that there's, like, a, I'm going to take, like, you all think you're coming in to watch a tragedy, you know, and through 99% of the movie, you're thinking it's a tragedy, like, you're waiting for the tragedy to befall, and he's like, but look at what you could be, what it can be, right? In the way of, like, somebody who has lived a life would try and say that to you, versus, like, I think Babylon, like, if we're gonna compare it to that, I think Damien got to the end of that. I really don't think he knew what the hell he was going to do with that ending.
I agree, because it goes on for like 30 minutes.
Too long. And us scrolling through all the movies. But in that way, he's like, look at how powerful the movie art form can be and is going to be. Mm-hmm. I don't think he earned whatever that is. Like, I think the stronger decision would just be to have that, you know, character see this film, be sad about the fact that all of the twists and turns his life has taken, and then gone back to his family, and, like, just everything, it just got really crazy.
Yeah.
But so, like, in here, I do feel like, you know, Francis Ford Coppola is a straight man, and I feel that, you know, an older straight man, and you sometimes older straight men have certain things, you know, that they've liked throughout their life, and those things are present in this movie.
That's fair to say.
I do feel
in terms of how it wraps up. Certainly, I get where you're at there. I do think he does know how to be collaborative. I will give him credit that way.
Oh yeah.
And there, I mean, there's not a lot of wiggle room for what's all that's happening here. But I do think there's the ambition shows.
I do feel like. Like, if you were to give another...
I guess I can't expect him to, like, entirely change who he is.
Yeah, and I don't think that he needed to, but I just, like, it is very present. But I think in a way, like, it's... I would be intrigued to see it again, to see it now knowing that it ends happier than I was expecting. Mm-hmm. Cause I was like, okay, here. I was like, ooh, this. Cause it, I think it would be juicy either way, and I'm intrigued. I'm on the heels of Speak No Evil.
Jesus Christ, this movie.
But just it, Speak No Evil has me thinking a little bit more about like American cinema and like what we do and are given. You know, given as the audience and do as the filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, I mean, Francis is obviously, you know, like he reshaped what that looks like for us.
Sure.
As people who were born, you know, after his 70s run, right? Mm-hmm. Scorsese did, like, all of the 70s filmmakers sort of really reshaped that. But at the same time, like, American cinema also has, like, innate qualities that it's had throughout its time. And so I'm, like, intrigued by these ideas of, like, Francis having this idea all those years ago and finally getting to make it now and how it sort of maps onto, like, the modern landscape but also hues very close to, you know, our ideals. And that's why I do think it ended happy.
Yeah, no, that,
you know, Americans love a happy ending.
Sure, but no,
we do.
You're not wrong. But I do see what you're getting at, and it's not like Francis Ford Coppola has shied away from having darker endings in the past either. Like it's not.
I mean, yes, Godfather is
every Godfather. The saga is a tragedy. That's the arc of the saga.
Yeah.
Every one of those has a downbeatness to it. They get progressively worse, honestly, when you really look at it.
That's what I think. It's like he sort of redefined that for us. You know, we've redefined visual language. He's helped redefine visual language of things.
Mm-hmm.
Him and his collaborators, right? So I do think he's bringing that into this story, but also, like, he's like, honestly, I feel like he... Maybe there's a kind of joy in the ending.
For sure. There's certainly a joy in the ending. As far
but
as
by that, I mean, there. Like, that he's like, I got to make this. And you can sort of feel the...
Oh, no, I agree with you there, too. I think which we have not talked about at all, but if, like, the plot hinges on the...
Because what are you going to say?
But, like, if the plot hinges on Caesar wants to build an Eden on Earth.
Yes.
And there's... people that are more self-inclined to think about themselves that are trying to basically stop him and do what they do, you know, hold on to quote unquote conservative nature of things. getting to like see a realization of Caesar's dream. That's great. That can be great. That can be presented in a way where I want to see what this looks like. I wish the movie was better at getting to that point and showing us that thing, perhaps, but do I feel as though by the time we get to the end, Francis Ford Coppola clearly is ending this movie at a point where he feels comfortable with? Yes, I could agree with that. I think he absolutely feels as though whatever edit this is, you know, this is the one he settled on because I feel like he's accomplished, you know, what he thinks needs to be said. When all is said and done here, will there be a Megalopolis Redux years from now?
God.
Will there be a Final Cut after that? I don't know. Maybe he tends to do that. But as it stands, no, I don't think he's putting this out in the world, hoping that a sizable portion of America shows up to ideally get him his money back.
Yeah.
I don't think he's putting this out there thinking, maybe. at least as far as how satisfied he was with the movie. I think he's very satisfied with the movie. He gave it 5 stars on Letterboxd.
He gave his own movie 5 stars on Letterboxd.
And damn right he should. stand by your art.
You might as well. Him and David Ehrlich.
I like the music in the movie.
Well, yes.
I think the mix of like Cecil B. DeMille 50s epic scores along with some other like dancing's ideas.
Yeah, going the tech on aspects of this movie are really something.
It's a good looking flick, honestly. I was upset.
The costumes, I was immediately upset.
There's some real choices being made with the costumes.
Because the way he introduces us to the is so smart, where it's like we're obviously we're in this party sequence, mm-hmm. and you're like, why are we spending so much time looking at strappy sandals? And then I was like, oh my god. And I was like, okay. And then we got the flowy, okay. And the Versace print. And I was like, okay, yes. That's what I mean. Like, there are moments in here where you're like, you're like, okay, we're in the hands of somebody who knows what the hell they're doing.
Well, that speaks to having like an internal drive that he understands. Something I constantly like to reference is
really,
the idea
really
that
smart.
It's smart. It's the idea of a filmmaker being like, even if the viewer can't like understand every single thing, take it, and it's not like the movie is laying it all out for you very simply. I do feel like if you were to ask Francis Ford Coppola point blank, what does this, and this mean, he has answers for all those questions. That's what the kind of movie this feels like. Whether or not he's edited it to perfection to make it seem that way or what have you, I do think that the effort he's put into what all of this means, why this is here, why this character means that, whatnot, I feel like he knows the internal structure of this thing. Conveying that, you know, on an outward level, that's the challenge of being a director, right?
Mm-hmm.
Balancing your own understanding versus what an audience is going to feel about that. That's why you get a Spielberg who is the most extreme example of knowing how that works. Mm-hmm. Like he can see shots, he can see what the film looks like from the outset and know what an audience wants to see and like make that work. Not every director can do that. That's why not every director is called one of the greatest directors.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else on Megalopolis? We talked a lot about this movie.
I'm
enjoying this conversation.
Yeah, I think it's so imagine me having to hold in these thoughts.
I get it.
All these thoughts for months before you saw it. I think we pretty much covered it.
Well, Megalopolis opens in theaters and IMAX this Friday, the 27th.
Mm.
When should people go and see this movie?
I do kind of think you have to go see it. You have to see it in order to believe it. I feel like you have to go see it at IMAX.
Well, good, because I agree. I do think that, I mean, if you have the opportunity to see a new Francis Ford Coppola passion project that he spent gobs of money on.
Yes.
Gobs. Yes, I absolutely recommend it. Again, I also really like this movie, but I think even if you feel more in Terrence's zone of being mixed, I don't think there's a downside to at least having experience what this
mixed
thing
to
is.
Bad. But yes, I agree. I just, because it's like, I agree.
Well,
and I wouldn't say this about Babylon. I definitely didn't think anybody... I think I might have been on that episode of Out Now, There, and in Ava.
I believe you were, actually, yes.
And yes, there are very few times I can recall being madder walking out of the theater than Babylon. Suburbicon is probably the number one most mad I've ever been walking out, and Babylon is in top five. So this wasn't... This was like... I just don't know how I'm going to explain this to people.
Well... As mentioned, Megalopolis opens up very soon. I'm not exactly counting on this, you know, breaking records at the box office, but I'll be very curious what the reaction is. I'll be curious what that cinema score is going to be the time we get to Megalopolis. But, Terrence, thank you very much for joining me for this.
Thank you for having me.
Where can people find more of you online?
You can find me at lenoirtour.net and on Twitter at Terrence B. Johnson.
Great. All right. Thanks again.
Thanks.